Hello and welcome to Blogosphere Serious Influence, the podcast all about the business side of the influencer industry. I'm Alice Audley and I'm the founder of Blogosphere, which hopefully you've heard of. But if not, Blogosphere is a media company rooted in the world of influencers. We run events, an influencer network, and publish a nationally distributed print magazine, and now a podcast too, which I'll be presenting. If there are any questions about the influencer industry that you want answered, be sure to tweet us your suggestions. Our Twitter handle is @blogosphereM. And if you want to learn more about influencers and the influencer industry, be sure to visit blogosphere magazine.com and invest in a subscription to our essential magazine. We're excited to announce that Series 1 of Serious Influence has an exclusive sponsor, the smart thinking money app, Yolt. Yolt is an app that I personally use, so I'm delighted to partner with them. You can sync your accounts, credit cards, and pensions in one view and track your spending habits, how much you're spending and what you're spending it on. I buy a lot of coffee. Yolt takes the stress out of budgeting and gives you the tools to achieve your financial life goals. For me, that's a trip to French Polynesia. Download Yolt for free from the App Store or Google Play Store today. Today on Blogosphere's Serious Influence, I'm joined by Rupa Shah. Rupa is a compliance expert and worked at the Advertising Standards Authority for 13 years. She founded her own influencer marketing consultancy, aptly named #ad, last year, and advises brands and influencers on best practices, including disclosure around advertisements. Before all this, Rupa started her career in broadcast journalism and also has a degree in law.
I studied law at university. But actually, I think I always knew very early on that I probably wasn't going to follow a traditional legal career. And I was really keen on journalism. And actually, so as soon as I finished my law degree, I went straight into a postgraduate diploma in broadcast journalism and then worked for probably about a year or so in for TV production companies as a creative and as a researcher. And then I heard about the job at the Advertising Standards Authority, which was an investigations job, and it just looked really appealing.
What was that sort of job, and did it tie in with anything that you were doing?
It did, because it coincided with the time when the ASA were just taking on board a broadcast remit. So previously, they had only looked at non-broadcast complaints, so complaints from magazines and newspapers, etc. But they were expanding, and they were starting to look at complaints about TV ads. So my broadcast experience was really helpful at the time. And also the legal background, it seemed to work really well, because when you're working at the ASA, every day you're interpreting the code, which is the CAP code, which contains all of the information about the rules that influencers and people from all sectors of marketing need to abide by.
So the CAP is a Committee of Advertising Practice.
Yes.
So tell me about the complaints that were coming in on TV ads at that time. What was the typical...
So we had a range of things. I looked at one, which was actually, it was a government campaign quite early on. And that surprised many people, because they didn't understand that actually the ASA has remit to investigate a government campaign. And that was an assault reduction one. So that was pretty interesting, because it was a lot of evidence that needed to be looked at. And actually we came down, we took a middle ground on that one in the end, because, you know, everyone knows you need to reduce the amount of salt. But I think the ad just took it slightly too far and sort of implied that it was dangerous, whereas... So it's quite important for everybody.
So they were saying that you need to reduce it further than you did?
Yeah. I think it was a bit absolute. I think they went just slightly too far in the amount that you needed to reduce it. And the impression given was that, I think they used a slug, and everyone knows you pour salt on a slug, how dangerous it is. So there were some objections from the salt industry at the time that, you know, you're really taking this too far. Everybody needs salt, so let's try and get a moderate ground on this.
And what year did you join the ASA? When are we talking?
Ooh, I think it was 2004.
Which coincides with the launch of Facebook. So you were there throughout the birth and evolution of social media. How did that change within your job role during your tenure at the ASA?
Well, actually, it took quite a while for the ASA to come on board with social media and websites in particular, because actually they were outside of our remit when I first started for many years. And then when we first sort of agreed to look at websites, there was a question of, well, what part of a website is advertising? Is it all of it? Is it just the page that's got selling points on? So all of these issues needed to be ironed out. And I think they did it in quite a good way. It was a careful process, a ruling, a little bit more consultation, another ruling to sort of get to a stage where everyone was in agreement of exactly what parts of the internet we can regulate, because it's huge. And
How big is the team at the ASA? How many employees do they have? Roughly?
I think when I left, there were probably about 100. And I think you're probably looking on casework, maybe around about 60. So actually, that's not very big. And, you know, if you think of us as the guardians of the internet, that's tiny. So, yeah, it's a tough job. But the fact is they rely on complaints. And at the time, you know, we weren't actually getting as many complaints as you might think, because people probably didn't realise that the ASA did look at the internet or regulate the internet.
When did social media complaints start for you?
So I suppose at the biggest point, it was from 2012, I would say. That was the point where the turning point, where we were starting to see more. And I think we started to see social media really burgeoning, people using it, you know, not just the stalwarts who you could, you know, switch between every type of Facebook platform, social media platform, but, you know, the general public was starting to use social media at that point. So yeah, it's probably around about 2012. And then obviously you get the subtleties and the changes within each platform, and you get different things, for example, Instagram stories and amendments to Twitter and the amount of characters. So all of these had to be fed into the policy of how the ASA considered ads.
Did you find that the ASA moved quite slowly with adapting to changes?
It was a tricky ground, because ultimately they're not creating new media. I mean, they had to be reactive to it to a certain extent, because that's their job. They, you know, they aren't there to tell advertisers what to do. They're not the creatives, and we weren't the creatives. So we had to be reactive to what the industry was doing. So in a way, you're always one step behind. Yes, I suppose that was a big criticism that was levelled all the time, that suddenly social media, when it exploded and it became actually a monetized industry rather than just your simple editorial blogs. Perhaps, yeah, the ASA didn't necessarily know exactly what was going on.
What is the worst thing that the ASA can do in terms of punishment to somebody?
It depends on what size of business you have. For example,
As a social media influencer.
As a social media influencer.
So, for instance, recently we had, obviously, differentiation, but a reality TV star that kind of falls under the influencer term, who are often actually a lot worse than digital influencers. But Louise Thompson from Made in Chelsea was in the news for not disclosing, and I think she got a warning. But had already been warned before.
She had,
so how many warnings do you have to have before you can actually do something that makes people stand up and be a bit more frightened? You know, is it a fine? Or does that link into the CAP?
So CAP or CAP, they're the sister body to the ASA. So they're the industry-facing side. They write the code and they give advice to advertisers. But they also apply sanctions. So Louise Thompson, she had a ruling against her in July. And as you say, another one. That's two in a year. So what the ASA will decide is whether, considering how much advertising she puts out, whether that does make her, they call it a repeat offender. And if she does fall under that category, then yes, they would consider taking further action.
What are those kind of actions that can happen, though? Because the ASA itself can't fine people, can it?
It can't. No, it's not in its list of sanctions. Ultimately, the final sanction is referral to trading standards, and they do have that ability to fine. They can take advertisers to court and then impose fines or injunctions.
What's the biggest fine that you've heard of? And have any social influencers been fined before? Do you know?
Not that I believe. So certainly not through the ASA and then on to trading standards process. There has been action taken by the CMA, and it has imposed fines on talent management and social media management companies. And I think we're looking at around about the £10,000 mark. But that's an entirely separate process. So the CMA are the Competition and Markets Authority, and they only take action if they think there's a whole sector that's misbehaving. And that was a couple of years ago. So, yeah, so it's, in terms of the ASA process, trading standards is the last point. But actually, with an influencer, I think what they will try to do is target their public face, really. What they want to do is try and get negative publicity against them. That's the main sanction that they would use against somebody who has a high profile.
This is the CMA.
This is the ASA.
ASA.
Yeah. So the CMA can fine.
So it's
it would be a new story. So exactly that. So they would make sure that ruling, that's, you know, these rulings are published every Wednesday. They would make sure that that ruling is accessible to journalists the day before. They're all ready and primed, and, you know, they'll alert them that this one is a social media story. And it will then be up to the media to take that and run with it. And, you know, from past experience, they've seen that that can be hugely consequential to individuals. Even large corporations can lose sort of stock value from that. So it's one of their tried and tested methods. But I think they might be moving on slightly now, because obviously it's a tried and tested method that works great for the larger companies. Does it really affect an influencer? You know, there haven't been enough rulings yet for us to know exactly where the right route is for that.
Out of the complaints that come to you, would you say that most of them are about the influencer, because obviously they've seen the post, but then in that breakdown between brand, talent management and influencer, who is mainly at fault?
It's difficult. If you read an ASA ruling against an influencer, you'll see that they talk about joint responsibility between the brand and the influencer. As the ASA considers, it's not really the agent's responsibility, although this is where the CMA come in. They would hold an agent responsible as well if they're not, you know, ensuring that, for example, that influencer has been told exactly where they need to put a hashtag ad. So as far as the ASA is concerned, the ruling will name both the influencer and the brand.
Do you think that the kind of codes of practice and advice that are being given are clear enough?
That's exactly what I was about to lead to. That is exactly why I left. So I had a year off on maternity leave, and then I left after a year. So I came back, and I was really keen to do some training at the ASA on influencer marketing because, you know, being off on maternity leave, you've got so much more time to consume social media. And I thought, oh, this is moving on really quickly. I'm sure, you know, there's lots going on and lots of training needed. But actually what I found on returning was potentially the ASA weren't necessarily keeping up and the training wasn't available, or I just felt that this was a really fast-moving industry, and actually the information that we were putting out, as you know, as CAP, didn't really target those who really wanted to know more. There were some high-level sort of help documents available, which potentially, if you're in the legal team of a large brand or a large talent agency, that would make sense to you. But down on the floor, if you're a marketing manager or you're leading a team, potentially of influencers, it didn't really make sense. It wouldn't really answer all of the questions that you needed. And it also wasn't really that easy for people to get in contact with CAP and get the advice that they needed that way, sort of direct route in.
Did the ASA have an advisory board of influencers that they talked to? Was that a thing?
No, they didn't. That wasn't a thing. And right now they're running a project where they're asking for responses from the social media industry to find out a little bit more about how consumers recognise what an ad is. So it's happening right now. But as you said, this is, you know, and as I said, this has been around for a long time, and there have been ads on social media for a very long time. So actually, that input would have been very welcome a lot earlier.
I also think that on the one hand, you've got people saying that they're kind of trying to get away with making it not look like an ad. But the root of the problem, the biggest cause of the problem, is actually education.
In terms of the influencer?
Yeah, I think a lot of influencers don't really know
what they need to be putting
there. I'm sure that some people, you know, the rules have been around for a while, and obviously if someone has paid you to do a post at a certain time and have control over it, that is an ad.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I think there are so many issues around disclosing. It's not just that you should disclose, it's where, how prominent, you know, what is the right disclosure message. And there are so many platforms now that actually, you know, actually in Louise Thompson's defence, she said she understood that in an Instagram feed, for example, she needs to put hashtag ad, but she didn't realise that Instagram stories needed it as well. So, you know, potentially as these...
I mean, that sounds a bit naive.
Potentially. Yeah. I think the problem is, though, because there are so many different types of platforms and the advice is either very generic that you get from CAP or it's very particular to one particular platform, that actually what you're expecting an influencer to cross-apply it in various scenarios with limited space, it's tough. It's difficult for them to understand exactly where things need to be. If they have an agent, great, they might be able to help them a little bit further, but not everybody does. So, you know, they are left out on their own trying to figure out what's the best way to, you know, do I need a hashtag ad? Where do I put it?
Do the ASA go and speak to talent agencies and have those meetings as well if they're not doing it direct or only just doing it direct with influencers now?
I've been away for a year now, so I've had my own business for a year. So in that time, I do believe that they've had some meetings. I'm aware that they've met with influencers and others within the industry to try and find out a little bit more. And as I said, they're running a project at the moment, a consultation, to find out more about what the average, you know, member of public who consumes social media understands by hashtag ad, for example. So, yeah, they're making the effort now, and there's definitely work going on to find out exactly what the public think of you know, so all of these social media disclosures.
In terms of advertising, we're seeing budgets increase, but predominantly a huge portion of that is going into Instagram. You mentioned earlier where in those posts you should be disclosing. Now, there is the paid partnership tool available to some brands. I don't think it's available to all brands. How does that work?
There are advantages for going through that method for a brand. So you've got all of the analytics that go alongside it. And it does, you know, as you probably see from the posts, it's very clearly highlights that there is a paid partnership with the influencer. So if that option is available to you, it's one way of very clearly disclosing an ad.
Is that deemed enough, though? Because I think there was maybe a ruling by the FTC. I mean, obviously, that's the US Federal Trade Commission.
That's right.
So many acronyms. That were saying that even if you do have that, I believe they were saying you still need hashtag ad at the bottom.
Yeah. See, this is the difficulty. We think it helps, and the ASA have said that the words, you know, or there's been information out that saying paid partnership is a great way of explaining that there's payment. But there is some ambiguity over partnership. So the ideal scenario at the moment is still to have hashtag ad, not hashtag spawn, not hashtag sponsored, to have hashtag ad. So if
what about hashtag SP? Seen that around?
Yeah, not great, no. I think because in the UK especially, we understand sponsorship to be zero editorial control. I mean, sponsorship on a football shirt, for example, that company is not telling that team how to play, what to do, anything at all. They're just giving them some money. There's no control, editorial control there. So sponsorship, at least in the UK, and I believe the FTC consider it the same way, is not a clear enough term. So sponsorship and SP, I don't recommend using them ever.
I wanted to talk to you a bit about press trips, big press trips where they take influencers away. Obviously, not speaking to someone from the press department who has outlined what happens on those, but hypothetically speaking, you're taken away on a trip, but then within the trip, you're told that you need to do at least 6 posts using a hashtag. You are not being paid for that. You're being taken on the trip. How should you disclose that?
That needs to be disclosed. So every post needs to be disclosed.
In what format? With ad?
Because with ad, with hashtag ad, exactly. So if a influencer is gifted a trip, they might not be given expenses, but the trip itself, potentially, if they're gifted that, that forms the payment part of the sort of two-step rule for whether this is an ad. So it doesn't matter that they haven't been given cash. If that trip has been paid for and they're told to produce 6 posts, then all of those posts need to be disclosed with hashtag ad.
Let's talk a bit about affiliate links, because that's kind of come up too. How do they need to be disclosed?
It's exactly the same as advertising. Affiliate links are a form of payment that isn't necessarily clear from the nature of the wording of that link, so the letters in the link or the wording of the link. So if, for example, on YouTube, you have a sort of list of 6 affiliate links on there, there should be some description there, very clear, and it shouldn't be buried at the bottom, and you shouldn't have to scroll down to find it, explaining that these are affiliate links. And going actually further and explaining what affiliate means, because currently there's an argument as to whether people understand what affiliate means, that it actually is payment. Payment will be given to a brand if you click on that particular link. So I've seen some great examples. Quite a lot of makeup and beauty bloggers have got some great disclaimers on there explaining what their affiliate links are. But the key thing is to be very clear which are affiliate links, if you've got a mix of links that are and which aren't. And actually, if you've got a post, for example, again, a YouTube video, all of your links are affiliate links, and actually the main content of your video is about advertising, then actually what we would say is that that entire video needs to be labelled as an ad.
There was some talk recently whether on sponsored Instagram pictures that on the actual picture there should be hashtag ad as well, which, I mean, it would look pretty ugly. Do you think that's a step too far?
Well, I think it is. I mean, I talk about hashtag ad a lot, partly because it's the name of my company and it helps, but actually it's not really the only way of disclosing. It's a really good way and it's an industry established way, but if you want to use your own tone of voice, then you can use that and introduce the fact that you were paid somehow to produce this content or to promote that product. And if that means you want to put up a little sign on your picture or while you're talking in your video, feel free to do it. There are various ways. It's not that you only should use hashtag ad.
Do you think that we're seeing social media influencers being picked on a bit by the mainstream press for not disclosing when actually there are still some dubious actions going on within magazines?
I think you're right. I think the press love to particularly take on social, you know, reality stars. So any mistake they make, whether that's in terms of what they're wearing and what they're doing or who they're with, they're always going to get picked up on because they are taking the limelight. So
I feel that the mainstream press, though, can have some time for people that have been in a traditional form of media and then have influence outside of it. But people that have made their name purely through social media, that's where it really jars with them. So any excuse to say how bad they are.
I think the problem is because if there's any type of challenge to their authenticity or their following, if you consider that their following is not necessarily organic, which you quite frequently have with someone who has an alternative career, you might, you know, they've given credos for that alternative career. So potentially, yeah, they have less sympathy for them. But in terms of whether they've got it wrong and the press jumping on an ASA ruling, the fact is there has to be a complaint first for there to be an ASA ruling. So somebody's complained, somebody's found that particular social media star, whoever they are, to be at fault.
Do the stories about traditional publishers breaking the regulations or not adhering to the regulations hit the press too in the same way?
Probably not. I mean, they probably did 5 years ago, and it was big news, and it was a way of actually enforcing rulings against them because, like I said, it's a great way for, you know, negative publicity is a great way for the ASA to make sure that those people they are ruling against comply. In terms of whether that's what we see in the news right now, so if you go to the ASA rulings page right now and have a little look through, you'll probably see Louise Thompson's ones on there right now, but, you know, that's maybe 10%. There are probably 9 other rulings on there that are nothing to do with potentially social media, or they might be websites, and they might be traditional press complaints. So, but they're not being picked up by the news because do people want to read about those? Probably not.
Did you read the article by Lucinda Chambers that has since been deleted, who was the former chief of something at Vogue and did a lot of the styling? And she left the business in the new Vogue run. And one of the things she said in this article was that she put a Tom Ford t-shirt or something to that effect on the cover to maintain, you know, kind of massage that relationship.
I haven't read the article. I know what you're talking about. I think, I mean, there has always been that sort of murky area with PR and journalism. And actually, the rules for influencers have evolved exactly straight out of that area of regulation. There isn't a separate section in the CAP code for influencers. We are just cross-applying those particular rules. So where we've always said that if there is a bit of brand input into some journalistic content, it must say advertorial at the top. So I think the rules have always been there, and they have always been enforced where consumers have complained about them. But this is a tricky area because a consumer has to know they are being misled to complain almost. So in the same way with influencers, we do get complaints, but actually some of them are very speculative because you can't know for sure that an influencer has been paid. You're guessing in a way, you believe it, or you're an avid user of that or reader of that blog. So you can sense it, and that's when you might complain. But so this is the reason why so much of it is sort of going unnoticed, in the same way that potentially it is in traditional media, as you say, with journalists and PR.
Another question about when complaints come in. There has been some conversation that if you are an influencer and complaining about another influencer because you're in the same field, then that automatically doesn't get taken seriously because you're seen as a competitor. Is that true? Is there any truth in that?
There's no truth in that, no. The ASA has always allowed competitor complaints. I mean, they do expect some level of resolution in advance of the complaint. So big companies, they have to follow a process where they have to contact each other and try to resolve it first. And if that doesn't work, then they accept a complaint. They certainly don't say there's an absolute ban on a competitor complaining. What an influencer would need to know, though, is that as a direct competitor, potentially, they would be named in the ruling as well. So they couldn't fly under the radar as a member of the public just who has a concern. Their name would go on that ruling too.
Do you have any specific influencers that you think are shining lights in the field?
I don't. I probably wouldn't name anyone in particular, just in case they turn around and see what they've missed hashtag hadn't they, last week. So no, I don't. I think what helps is those that have talent management behind them to kind of back it up and give them extra advice. But there are plenty that just seem to be great at, you know, doing it very organically and doing it in a very nice... I mean, what I really enjoy seeing are those posts that don't use hashtag ad, actually, but they've seamlessly included some level of, you know, I've been paid or this was sent to me.
And that is okay. There. So if you disclose this is a paid-for post in collaboration with... That's the same as putting hashtag
ad. Yeah, it has the same status. Yeah,
same status.
Provided it's not buried further down and, you know, you have to scroll to find it. If it's in a, for example, in an Instagram ad and you can see it very clearly at the top of the description before all of the hashtags, then yes, that's absolutely fine. And sometimes that looks better. And it doesn't mean that you're going to miss it because as long as it's, as I said, it's there and not buried under something else.
I mean, really, if you're doing ads, obviously you do need to kind of pay the bills, and it is a luxury, I suppose, for every single advertisement that you do to be 100% aligned, in all honesty. Mm-hmm. But the best type of ads are ads that you're proud of and you want to shout about and say that you are paid for doing them.
I agree. Yeah. I think if you feel like you've got it right and that brand really works with the rest of your content and it just fits in, then I can't see why, you know, and the stats prove it as well, that actually there's not necessarily a negative reaction to a hashtag ad. You know,
what is the sort of data on that then? Does engagement drop when there is hashtag ad, or does it not drop as much as one would think?
It doesn't drop as much as one would think. I've seen a whole variety of stats on this. It depends which agency you go to for it. But the general consensus is it doesn't necessarily, it's not hazardous, certainly, to you. And actually, you'll see a drop if it's a really jarring ad and it's a product, potentially, that really doesn't fit with the influencer. But those influencers who really understand what they're doing and they've, you know, organic and seamlessly and just are using products that really do make sense for them to be promoting, then there is very, very little drop.
A prime example of one that doesn't fit often, that is everywhere, is obviously the skinny tea kind of ads.
Yep.
Which are so frequently not disclosed. Does it not make one wonder if that's coming from the source?
Yeah, I mean, this is one thing I've seen in my first year actually of business. There are some products that are created to be influencer marketed 100%. I mean, you really don't see ads in any other format. And there are some products that you can almost be pretty certain the message going out, if it may not be a deliberate please do not hashtag ad this, but the sense is that this is not what we want you to do. So I have to say there are plenty of products, the flat tummy tea type ones, where that is the ethos behind them.
And then on the other flip side, I suppose that's kind of a low rent example. And if we're to look at the luxury market that did come under fire a bit earlier this year with Saddlebag Gate, where bags worth upwards of £600 were gifted to a variety of influencers. Could you tell me a bit more? Do you know that case? Could you tell me a bit more about that case?
Yeah.
Or luxury brands gifting?
Yeah, I mean, it's always been done. It's as we talked about previously, it's that murky line between PR. I mean, there have always been gifts and gifts to journalists or, you know, gifts to the media. What the ASA says, it needs to be a step further for it to be an ad. So you need to exert, as a brand, some level of editorial control as well as gifting. So what it might be is they might say, we're gifting this to you, could you do 4 posts and could you write positively about the brag? Or could you ensure you include a link to our website, for example? So those messages from the brand take it to the second step, which is editorial control. So I think we know that the gifting goes on, and some brands are just very, very careful about not overstepping that mark and giving no editorial control whatsoever or editorial direction.
Is hashtag gifted important?
Hashtag gifted is, it's not something the ASA have specifically commented on or cap. It gives some information to the user. I think that's helpful, but it's not. I mean, the CMA... So whereas the ASA feel there needs to be a two-step process, actually, as I said, there's this other regulatory body, the CMA, they also feel that gifting should be disclosed. So hashtag gifted, there's no official comment on that at the moment, so it's difficult for me to interpret. But I think safer ground at the moment is you can use hashtag gifted, but also have some level of disclosure there to explain that this has been, you know, the brand has passed this on.
When you go to the ASA website, Is there one destination that you can go that has all influencer marketing?
I wish there was, because I go on it frequently and dig around. There isn't one place. I mean, they have a search mechanism you can use. So you could type in influencer or affiliate in their search resource bar. It will pull up some material that may be useful to you. It will also pull up a sort of a range of things that potentially, or rulings, which you may not want to, you know, read in their entirety. So yeah, there isn't a dedicated influencer section there at all, no.
And do you often have brands that say that they did tell the influencer to use it and they didn't? And then where does the responsibility lie in that case? Is it the person that's spent?
Yeah.
How does that work?
That's a really big question, actually, because it comes up time and time again. And it's a response that the ASA received time and time again from the brands, because it might be standard in the contract and they might not read their contract. I mean, that might be as simple as it. They're signing on the dotted line. And actually, it says within the contract that you have to comply with ASA regulations, or some contracts are very clear and state you must use hashtag ad, where you need to use it, at what times. But ultimately, it is that influencer who's hitting the upload, and the brand can do as much as it wants to do, but actually ultimately the influencer can decide whether or not to put it in. So as I said, the ASA held the brand and the influencer jointly responsible, so they will accept that response from the brand and they will note it in their ruling, but that will still be an upheld ruling, unfortunately.
That must leave a bitter taste in the mouths of the brands.
Yeah, it does. And I think, you know, the brands I've worked with, the ones that have done it for a few years now, are being more careful about the influencers they use. And that's the only way around it. So it's not just a matter of, as you know now, likes and followers, and that, you know, they're much more savvy about choosing these influencers very, very carefully in terms of the working relationship between the brand and the influencer.
Do you have trust in the influencer industry as a whole?
I do. I think with any industry, there's a sort of a settling time with everything. And influencer marketing is new. It's a new field. And there are so many players involved. There are, as I said, the tech platforms, the brands, the agencies, the talent management, the influencers. They all need to understand what the regulations are. The regulatory bodies, and unfortunately we have two of them here in the UK, which complicates things a little bit. They need to put out the right messages.
Could they ever merge and have a union body on influencer marketing? Would that help?
Well, they speak to each other. The ASA, their rules are drawn from the same law that the CMA operates on. So there is a common ground and there is communication between the two. But in terms of producing a perfect sort of project that explains exactly what influencers are doing, that's just not really going to happen. It's just...
Do you think they really care about influencer marketing? Because surely more effort would have been put in faster if they did. Not to make you slander somebody.
I know.
On the podcast. But do you think that we need to have someone really spearheading that department that gets it? Because, two bodies drawing up guidelines that some of them conflict with each other, and then you're having influencers being penalised. It feels like people need to pull the finger out and actually, you know, sort it out.
Yeah, I mean, that's the ideal scenario, isn't it? One body just telling you exactly what you need to do and giving you some really clear rules that work for every platform. Go out there, do that. Is it going to happen?
Do you think hashtag ad will push your business, push out the ASA and become the new body?
That would be ideal, wouldn't it? The ultimate scenario. But I mean, unfortunately, what we, you know, as hashtag ad at the moment, we're sort of beholden to what the ASA are putting out. And
so it must be a daily frustration then for you as well. And I actually wanted to ask you, you spoke briefly about contracts before. Is there anywhere where you can get, at the moment, examples of good contracts between brands and influencers so people can look from and learn from, so that communication is clear? Could you put an example contract out on hashtag ad, or would that be a problem?
No, I mean, you could. I mean, it doesn't have to include anyone's identity. So, a template contract, it's potential. And I think there are... You could probably find some just Googling them. There's probably some out there that you could find.
Just trustworthy resources.
Yeah. But, you know, are they necessarily 100% trustworthy? Because everything moves on so quickly. And that's why I'm in this business, because, you know, next week there might be another ASA ruling that kind of clarifies that hashtag spawn is no good, or hashtag. And what you've got in your template has moved on again. And it's just the nature of the way regulation works here in the UK. So you've got to be really careful not to rely on one document too heavily, because everything moves on very quickly. What you need is continual up-to-date training guidance, or to be aware of what's going on. Contracts are important, they're super important, and I know lots of influencers don't actually even use them. And that can be fine too. An email exchange, it might have enough information for you to know what you're doing. I am an advocate for having a great contract that includes exactly how you need to enclose.
Do you find that your legal background has helped there as well?
It has helped, yeah, definitely. I think some experience of understanding how they set out and, you know, where to put the important information, the important terms and clauses does, yeah, it comes in handy. And it also kind of helps me in, when I'm dealing with lots of, you know, marketing teams, and they have plenty of other legal questions that I can occasionally help them with. Because, of course, the CAP code here in the UK, the ASA code, it doesn't cover issues such as intellectual property and copyright and trademarks and things like that. So,
Goodness, well, that's a Pandora's box. We should get into that. What about influencers taking other influencers' posts?
Yeah, well, I mean,
it's a minefield, isn't it?
It is a minefield, yeah. And unfortunately, the ASA system is really easy to use, but they don't deal with that. So,
and then do people report that in, I suppose, quite a lot? Instagram post has been taken.
Yeah, I mean, you get lots of things. What was happening quite frequently was we were getting complaints by, and I think it was really important information, influencers who were telling us that brands had specifically told them not to disclose. But actually, at the ASA, that's not something you deal with. You can't deal with that. You're looking at ads, and what they're complaining about is the absence of an ad almost. So, yeah, it was very interesting working at the ASA, because you do see all of these areas and you can see the type of things that are being complained about.
How does your pricing tiers work then to make it available to people? Do you find that you're doing kind of one-off consulting, or do you have people on retainer? But I mean, obviously you've been running for a year now, so what's your business model?
So there are all options available. What I'm finding is that the brands that I've worked with a couple of times and done a few training sessions are now looking for that retainer option, because they need to have that ongoing, be able to pick up the phone and say to me, you know, we've got 4 affiliate links out of 5. Does that make it an ad? That type of question. So I do offer a retainer option to the brands. For tech platforms, quite often that's a project, and it might be that you've got a tech platform expanding into the UK and they've got questions about compliance with the CMA, the ASA and GDPR. So we'll go on a project basis there. And actually for influencers, I have only just sort of created a new package there, which is going to go up on my site very soon. And what I'm offering is a sort of a newsletter option. So a monthly subscription where I will take all those ASA rulings that they really don't really want to read, and the guidance that's been updated, and updates on the project that the ASA are running, and just break it down and explain how that will be applied to their ads.
When people are burying the hashtag ad in the caption, but it's still there, it's still complying, even though people are trying to make it hidden.
There are levels. Yeah, if it's hidden, it depends. If it's hidden in a sort of a list of, say, 20 or 30 hashtags, and it's sort of in there or near the bottom, then that's not compliant. If it's in a paragraph of wordings, of content wording, it might stand out. It sort of depends. But again, if it's gone so low that you need to scroll to find it, that's not compliant.
That's interesting.
Yeah. So actually, the ASA, they really do look at it on a case-by-case basis. And that's why I think in some ways they're a bit loath to put out really detailed guidance, because they know there are so many variations out there that the minute you say very specifically it must be in the second line, well, actually Instagram will introduce another feature and actually a second line could appear somewhere else. So, yeah, I think that's kind of the struggle with the way the platforms continually change their formats.
Do the platforms have good relationships with the ASA? So do Facebook come and talk to the ASA?
That's really interesting. So around about 3 years ago, I would have said no. I mean, very little relationship, aside from the ASA contacting them occasionally to say, we're really concerned, you've got a lot of Botox ads on here, and they'll come back and say, we didn't notice, or, all right, sorry, we'll look at it. But yeah, I mean, I've been a year out of the ASA, so I believe they have a better relationship with the platforms. Not in terms of a direct hotline where they can say, pull this, pull it now. it just doesn't work that way. There is still, I mean, it's bureaucratic for all sides, really. And the platforms have their own rules and their own criteria on what they accept and they don't accept. So potentially something that breaches the CAP code is actually acceptable there, and then there's some discussion and you need to prove exactly why it's a breach of the CAP code. So yeah, my experience of working in the compliance team was actually, it can be quite tough sometimes dealing with the platforms.
Is there quite a bit about data that the ASA deal with now? So for instance, Facebook using data that they've harvested in different ways and then using that data to push ads against. Does that then fit within the ASA's?
Yeah, there's a bit of a murky area with data. Traditionally, there was a section of the code that dealt with data. They're in a sort of a transitional period with that while GDPR settles in as to how much the ASA can deal with data complaints. Yeah, I've no idea. You know, I've had a couple of questions about sort of GDPR-related email marketing, for example, that I've not really been able to get to the bottom of because everyone's kind of waiting for that first ICO, the Information Commissioner ruling, or, you know, guidance, because that's the settling in area at the moment with GDPR.
Do you think that it will ever truly 100% be under control?
No, I don't think so, because I don't think any advertising has ever been 100% under control in any sector. It ever will. I mean, the point is, you know, you go into that industry to be creative and push boundaries. And I don't think any sort of director really knows themselves exactly where the line is at any one time. So if you're pushing boundaries, and I think you should be with advertising, it's a creative industry, there will always be upheld rulings against those ads. So influencer marketing is no different. It's going to be the same. So there will be a series of ASA rulings, and there will continually be ASA rulings that will get you closer to a sort of a narrow point of what is acceptable. But there will not be that point where everybody is complying.
But you do feel positive about improvements that are happening?
I think so, yeah. I think it's about getting the message out. I've been to so many influencer marketing conferences recently and seminars, and the emphasis is now very much on disclosure and transparency. These questions come up so much more, and the accusations, which previously were that it's the Wild West, we don't know what we're doing, so we're just going to crack on with the same old format, that's coming up so much less now. And with sort of automation and AI, actually, it makes it easier for disclosure to be tracked, to inputted, tracked, followed by all parties. So that helps, I think. I think AI is a big thing, actually, for the influencer industry. It's only going to serve for good because it makes so many processes so much easier. I mean, we talk about fake followers, and actually, I think that's a whole other area.
Yeah, I was going to go into that, but I thought that might...
Yeah, it's a murky area, and I don't think necessarily AI is always going to stop that, but certainly for disclosure and transparency, and some of the great things I've seen quite a few different tech platforms doing to really assist and make that clearer and allow brands to really see what their influencers are doing and give, you know, alerts if somebody hasn't used a hashtag ad, if that's their choice. That will help the industry.
A big thanks to Rupa for coming on the show. You've been listening to Blogosphere Serious Influence with me, Alice Audley. Join us next week for a brand new episode. Until then, be sure to check out blogosphere.com for influencer industry updates. And why not treat yourself to a magazine subscription whilst you're there?